TUC Radio San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness.
Just 3 days prior to the ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization in Seattle in early December 1999, 2,500 people crowded into Benaroya Symphony Hall. They were attending the most recent teach-in by the International Forum on Globalization, the IFG. Over 1,000 others stood outside in the rain, hoping to get past the fire marshals. And you are about to hear what they missed. No other organization has so consistently alerted the public to the risks and consequences of the provisions of the Global Trade Agreement. The IFG warned already 6 years ago that the mission of the WTO is to diminish our power to make laws about public health, food safety, the environment, labor standards, and even culture, while creating a set of rules that shift power from nation states to multinational corporations. However, for much of those last 6 years, the public seemed disinterested, and the commercial media mentioned only one aspect of the WTO, the lowering of tariffs for goods. All this changed during 1999. Third world countries feel betrayed by false promises. Environmentalists are concerned about the power of the WTO to subvert U.S. laws such as the Clean Air Act. Labor sees manufacturing move abroad in pursuit of 30-cent-an-hour wages. They all woke up to the agenda of the WTO. A huge, successful effort was made by many organizations to bring as many of their members to Seattle as possible. Today's and next week's program bring you two speakers from the festive opening session of the teach-in on Friday, November 26th. Next week's speaker is Susan George, one of the best-known and respected writers on third world debt and a rare guest to her home country. She now lives and works in Paris. Today you will hear from Maud Barlow. She's a major public figure in Canada and is often called Canada's Ralph Nader. She has been a leading campaigner against the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement and NAFTA and the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, the MAI. As National Chair of the Council of Canadians in Ottawa, with 100,000 members, she enjoys grassroots support from farm and women's groups and from environmentalists and teachers. Many Canadians say that she could run successfully for Prime Minister. Maud Barlow is the author of 5 books on trade and education. In spite of her busy schedule, she is writing and researching new issues. You will now hear her extraordinary talk on the privatization and commodification of the planet's last remaining fresh water. Maud Barlow.
Well, hello, Seattle. Wow. I want to tell you that I've got 2 things on my jacket. The first is a button that says Seattle, 11/30/1999, the day the WTO stands still. Let's make it happen. And I've also got a gold ribbon on my lapel here. I spoke last night in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, to the National Farmers Union and a Canadian Farm Women's Conference. And the women asked me to take this ribbon to Seattle, to wear it all week, to give me courage and remind me what we're doing here. And they reminded me, and I will tell you, that we, although we have had record exports of agricultural products in the last year, we have the lowest net farm income at the farm gate since 1926, when Canada first started taking any kind of statistics on this. So something's really wrong somewhere, and I wear this very proudly on behalf of the farmers of my country. Now, I came across a little quote from Woodrow Wilson in 1907, and I thought it might set the tone for us as we get ready for this week. Woodrow Wilson said this about trade. He said, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and manufacturers insist on having the world as a market, the flag of the nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of an unwilling nation be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Well, he sure got his dream, didn't he? Well, here we are. We're gathered to confront the largest concentration of corporate power ever assembled. Trade ministers and the negotiators of 135 countries are going to be greeted by the WTO host committee, co-chaired by Bill Gates of Microsoft and Phil Condit of Boeing Corporation. These folks have, I know indeed, my dears, they've promised their corporate friends that for a certain amount of money, and the more you pay, the higher access you get, you can speak directly to the politicians and the trade negotiators. Needless to say, there's no such official welcoming host committee made up of environmentalists and justice advocates and union activists, although I dare say we're going to give them the odd unofficial welcome this week. The WTO has become the most powerful institution in the world, and I think we need to remember why we are here and why it is so dangerous, because it now touches every part of our lives. What makes the WTO so powerful and so dangerous is that it has both the legislative and judicial power to challenge the laws, policies, and programs of countries that do not conform to the lowest common denominator rules set by the WTO and to strike them down if they're seen as being hostile to unregulated trade. In fact, as we know, the WTO has become the most powerful tool of transnational capital. And these corporations work hand in hand with trade bureaucrats in Geneva and Washington and Ottawa and everywhere that they exist to establish what is, in essence, a system of global corporate governance. Now, at the heart of the WTO is an assault on everything left standing in the commons, in the public realm. Everything is now for sale. Even those areas of life that we once considered sacred, like health and education, food and water and air and seeds and genes and heritage. It is all now for sale. Economic freedom, not democracy, and not ecological stewardship is the defining metaphor of the WTO. And its central goal is humanity's mastery of the natural world through its total commodification. Now, I want to take my few minutes here tonight to sound the alarm about one aspect of this. You're going to hear so many different areas of concern around the WTO, but I want to talk about the potential impact of the WTO on the very source of life, which is water. The destruction of aquatic ecosystem health and the increasing water scarcity are, in my opinion, the most pressing environmental problems facing humankind. The first myth to counter is that there is a lot of water to go around. We're treating it badly, but there's lots of water. This is not true. The amount of fresh water available in the world is only 0.5% of the total world's water stock. And every year that needs to stretch to welcome 85 million new people into the world. Yet we are depleting, diverting, and polluting that finite supply at an astonishing rate. Today, 31 countries are facing water stress and scarcity, and over a billion people lack access to clean drinking water. We know that 5 million people, most of them children, die every year from illnesses caused by poor drinking water. If we do not change our ways, by the year 2025, as much as 2/3 of the world will be living in either water scarcity or total water deprivation. This is the major environmental crisis of our time. Groundwater overpumping and aquifer depletion are now an urgent problem in the world's most intensive agriculture areas, and water is being depleted many, many times faster than nature can replenish it. This means that instead of living on water income, we are now living on water capital, and we are facing water bankruptcy. The global expansion in mining and manufacturing is increasing the threat of pollution, and these underground water supplies are contaminating aquifers all over the world. 90% of most of the world's communities still dump their raw sewage directly into the waterways of the world. At the same time, overexploitation of the planet's major river systems is threatening another finite source of water. From the Nile in Egypt to the Ganges in South Asia to the Yellow River in China and the Colorado in America, these are just some of the major rivers that no longer reach the sea. And, of course, we've diverted and overtapped and dammed our waterways to the point that they no longer exist in their natural forms. All through Latin America, China, and Asia, massive industrialization is affecting the balance between humans and nature in rural communities. Agribusiness, growing crops for export, is claiming more and more of the water once used by family and peasant farmers for food self-sufficiency, and industry is creeping up the major river systems, drinking them dry as they go. Already, as big industrial wells probe the water, millions of Chinese farmers have found their wells pumped dry, and 80% of China's major rivers are so degraded they no longer support fish. Similarly, 75% of Russia's lake and river water is unsafe to drink. There is simply no way to overstate the danger of this water crisis to the planet today. The World Bank and many others have said that the wars of the next century will be about water. I want to say that no piecemeal solution is going to prevent the collapse of whole societies and ecosystems, and that a radical rethinking of our values, priorities, and political systems is urgent. And yet, just as humanity is beginning to face this stark crisis, political leaders of just about every stripe have embraced the ideology of economic globalization, and they're integrating their national and local economies into a single, deregulated global market, thereby freeing transnational capital from the constraints of domestic law. All over the world, governments are dismantling environmental legislation or allowing industry to police itself, essentially commodifying nature. In fact, forces are already at work that would see water become a private commodity to be sold and traded on the open market, controlled by transnational corporations, and guaranteed to the private use of capital through global trade and investment agreements of the WTO. In industries ranging from municipal water and wastewater services to an explosion in bottled water to the mass bulk water removals by tanker, corporations are lining up to exploit the increasingly desperate global demand for water. Water is the last infrastructure frontier for private investors, says the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development president. The world of privatized water is overwhelmingly dominated by two transnationals from France, Vivendi and Suez Lyonnais des Eaux, the General Motors and Ford Company of the water world. They are joined by mega energy industries like Enron that has just set up a water division headed by the dreaded Rebecca Mark, who swears she will not rest until the entire world's water is privatized. And then, of course, there are global shipping companies eager to begin the global trade in commercial bulk water. Now, governments and international government agencies are paving the way for the commodification of water. The UN Economic and Social Council Commission on Sustainable Development actually proposes that governments turn to large multinational corporations for capital and expertise and call for an open market in water rights. At a recent UN conference in Paris, governments proposed to turn water into a global commodity driven by market forces and higher prices, and they called for an enlarged role for the private sector. Now, in this, they have a good friend in the World Trade Organization, because high on the list for negotiations this week in Seattle are services, and high on the list within the services sector is an item called environmental services, which includes water. If environmental services are put on the table, every member country of the WTO will have to open its municipal water services and, in fact, the governance of all its natural resources to global private competition. And the transnational corporations will have the right to bid for public funding in these areas. By the way, the same service agreement is talking about opening up health, education, and social programs as well. Further, both the WTO and the North American Free Trade Agreement have adopted the GATT definition of a good, which includes water. Now, this is very important because Article 11 of the GATT specifically prohibits the use of export controls for any purposes and eliminates quantitative restrictions on imports and exports. The WTO and NAFTA both ensure what's called national treatment to transnational corporations, which means they basically can help themselves to a country's water the moment it issues its first permit. Now, the GATT does have a provision called Article 20, which purportedly allows countries to use certain measures to protect natural resources, but the use of Article 20 can be challenged as a disguised barrier to trade, and every time any country has tried to protect an environmental or health law, using Article 20 against a WTO challenge, the WTO has won. In any case, the few measures allowed by Article 20 are not permitted under NAFTA, which gives additional rights to North American corporations to sue for financial compensation if these rights are denied to them. Already, we have a huge case in Canada. Sunbelt Water of Santa Barbara, California, is suing the Canadian government for $10.5 billion in damages because the company lost a contract to export bulk water when the government of British Columbia banned its export in 1993. The corporation rightly says that NAFTA gives it the right to involve itself in Canadian government policy. And I quote the president, Jack Lindsay, who says, because of NAFTA, we are now stakeholders in the national water policy of Canada. But Americans have equal cause for concern. Alaska has become the first jurisdiction in the world to pass legislation permitting the export of bulk fresh water for commercial purposes. A British Columbia company called Global Water Corp has signed a contract with Sitka, Alaska to export 18 billion gallons of glacier water per year and ship it by tanker to be bottled in one of China's infamous free trade zones. The company boasts on its website that the deterioration of the world's water quality is a great investment opportunity, and I quote, "Water has moved from being an endless commodity that may be taken for granted to a ration necessity that may be taken by force." Now, if Alaska were to change its mind, under the international trade rules as they exist, Global Water Corp could sue the U.S. government for all lost profit, present and future. And yet, when several governors around the Great Lakes asked Mr. Clinton this past week if he would allow the water issue to be raised at these talks this week, he said no. Now, this must not be allowed to happen. Water must be exempted from both NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. As I might add, so must the trade in genes, seeds, air, health, education, social services, natural resources, and culture. This is not to say that those of us living in water-rich areas of the world don't have a responsibility to those living in areas of water deprivation, particularly since we have to recognize that it's the corporations of the first world that have done such damage in the third. But there is a world of difference between water sharing and water trading. You can be sure that under the WTO, it would not be the world's poor who would gain access to water. Rather, countries, water-intensive corporations, free trade zones, and wealthy communities able to pay top dollar would win that prize. Now, this is just the first step to prevent the commodification of the world's water. In Canada, we formed a coalition of civil society groups called Water Watch. We're developing what we call a water ethic based on the principle that water belongs to the earth and all species, is a vital part of the earth's heritage, and is a fundamental human right. Therefore, water must be preserved in the public domain for all time and protected by strong local, national, and international law. At stake is the whole notion of the commons, the idea that through our public institutions, we recognize a shared human and natural heritage to be preserved for future generations. We believe that citizens and communities around the world must be the keepers of our waterways and must establish community organizations to oversee the wise and conserving use of this precious resource. And I quote to you a lovely way of describing how water is so personal to us by Michael Parfit from the National Geographic. He says, "Watersheds come in families, nested levels of intimacy. On the grandest scale, the hydrologic web is like all humanity. Serbs, Russians, Cuyahokan Indians, Amish, the billion lives in the People's Republic of China. It's broadly troubled, but it's hard to know how to help. As you work upstream toward home, you're more closely related. The big river is like your nation, a little out of hand. The lake is your cousin. The creek is your sister. The pond is her child. And for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, you're married to your sink." In closing, I just want to say that it is my fervent hope that civil society, you and me, and all of us who are gathering here this week in Seattle, will adopt this water ethic and make our mark as never before in this international gathering. And just who are we coming together from all over the world here in Seattle? Well, we are the seed keepers of democracy. We are educators and frontline healthcare workers. We are First Nations people. We are anti-poverty and social justice activists. We are committed environmentalists. We are working people from every corner of the earth. We are old and young and everything in between. We represent the majority of the earth's people, and we demand to be heard in the corridors of power. We stopped the MEI in its track, and we found that we prefer winning to losing. We put these people on notice. We will be here beyond Seattle. And we are committed with our lives to building a different model and a different future for humanity, the earth, and other species. We have envisioned a moral alternative to economic globalization, and we will not rest until we see it realized. Thank you.
That was Mal Barlow, recorded at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization in Seattle in November of 1999. She is the national chair of the Council of Canadians. Her 45-page pamphlet on water is called Blue Gold. You can order a copy through the website of the International Forum on Globalization at www.ifg.org. That's www.ifg.org. In the remaining 6 minutes of this program, I will bring you a brief preview of next week's program. Susan George is an American by birth, but she now lives in Paris. In Europe, she's well known as an outspoken leader in opposition to the free trade model of Maastricht, the European Union, and the MAI. She is a prolific writer with several books on the Third World Debt Crisis. A recent book with Fabrizio Sabelli, Faith and Credit, is a devastating critique of the World Bank, Robert McNamara, and the arrogance of the globalization elites. Susan George.
You've heard of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. You've heard of the Battle of Gettysburg. You've heard of D-Day. Well, this is the Battle of Seattle. And it's just as much a historical turning point as any previous battle in the history of this country or any other. And I'm not using the idea of a battle or a war as just a metaphor or an image. I think we are really at war. Not all of us perhaps are aware of this, but everything fits. As in other wars, there's an objective. It's the control of the world, the world's wealth. It's an objective of power. You don't need tanks and missiles necessarily to carry out a war. You can use other methods. And if you want access to all world resources, whether financial or material or natural or human, obviously you're going to have to fight for that. So here we've got an adversary, we've got an enemy, which is the whole corporate system. And the objective of that corporate system, whether financial or industrial, is to be able to go where it wants and produce what it wants, when it wants, for as long as it wants, and to make as much money, obviously, as it can, and damn the costs. The goal is profit, and anything that enhances that goal is good. Now, you notice that in this model, there's absolutely nothing about employment. There's nothing, obviously, about social justice, about the environment, any of those things. Those are just side effects. But transnationals have to have rules. Any system has to have rules. Even the mafia has rules. I think they need three things. They need the freedom of capital movements. That is something that the IMF takes care of. The IMF imposes its law on countries in the South and now the East, and it insists that capital be free to cross their borders in all directions. And the IMF has been able to put those laws into effect because countries have been so indebted. That's one set of rules. They wanted freedom of investment. And that is what they were trying to get through the multilateral agreement on investment, through the MAI. And they were absolutely stunned when popular movements defeated the MAI. Stunned. And don't think it's not going to come back if they have anything to say about it, because it is. That's one of the things that is likely to be, in one way or another, on the agenda of the WTO. And then they need a third set of freedoms, which is, of course, the movement of goods and services. And that's what the GATT took care of at one point. And now it's the WTO with much more forceful means. Everything in the world and every aspect of human activity is defined as tradable. All our activities are objects of trade. Agriculture, natural resources, life forms, services alone. It's 11 different sectors, including health and education and environment, as Maud told us, and 160 subsectors. I don't care what your job is or what industry you are in, what you're working on, I will bet you that it can be found under the rules of the WTO.
That was a preview of the talk by Susan George that you will hear next week on TUC Radio. Susan George is the director of the Transnational Institute and president of the Observatoire de la Mondialisation. She spoke at the opening session of the International Forum on Globalization in Seattle on the eve of the December 1999 session of the World Trade Organization. TUC Radio is supported by listeners like you. A one-hour copy of the talks by Susan George and Maud Barlow is $10. A transcript is $7. Send your check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. For a credit card order, call TUC Radio toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE. That's 877-TUC-TAPE. The music is by G.S. Sarstev. My name is Mariah Gallardin. Thank you for listening.